The following program is the result of oral history interviews conducted by the sub-freshman students at University Laboratory High School. The oral history project is done each year as part of the history curriculum and represents hours of preparation in both historical content and interviewing techniques. It is an activity designed to help students understand how history comes to be, how events are interpreted, and what lessons are learned. This year's presentation focuses on immigration. It is to honor those who took risks of all kinds to leave their country of origin and come to America, specifically to East Central Illinois. They now live quiet and productive lives, yet their stories, their insights, and their very presence here enriches all of us in ways that we often take for granted. This program is entitled Journey to a New World.
I was born in Ohio, September 14, 1918. We came from the northern part of Italy, close to Venice.
Well, it's a small village, Nobiskrug, in Germany. And my birthday, May 28, 1917. That's close to my whole family. I also have had two brothers and one sister, and they're all gone now except my one brother.
I grew up in Nuremberg. That's in southern Germany. It's a very old city, famous for gingerbread and beautiful old buildings. And I had a very happy childhood. I'm the oldest of four.
I grew up in Ecuador, South America. I live with my parents and 8 brothers and sisters.
I was born in Beijing. It has about 11 million people living in this town. It's like a Washington, D.C., as in the United States.
These are the voices of some of the people who have immigrated to this country over the last century. Despite the wide range of places of origin and reasons for coming to America, they have all found themselves in Champaign-Urbana. Coming from countries around the world, they represent many backgrounds, beginning with many different childhood experiences. This diversity has obviously spawned a wide variety of childhood memories that have stayed with the immigrants even until today.
Times were really hard there, and inflation was so high that money didn't mean anything. 500 million marks, and it wouldn't even buy a loaf of bread. My dad was a carpenter. When he'd get done with a job, he had to stay up all night to count the money, and it wouldn't buy anything, maybe a couple loaves of bread.
Grammar schools were nice. We used to walk about a mile and a half from home to the school, and the principal used to let us go in through the engine room in the wintertime because it was cold walking, and we could go into the school before school hours, where the children from the neighborhood there couldn't go in until I think about 10 or 15 minutes before school started. But we had the privilege of going into the school, and then we also had privileges of taking showers, which we never had because we lived out in the country.
When I was 6, 1947, incidentally, that was the year India became independent of the British rule. So there were a lot of changes in the educational system as I went along. Most children started to learn English in the fifth grade. They changed it. The year I came to the fifth grade, they postponed it to the eighth grade. So I didn't get to start learning English until I was in the eighth grade. It was a big school, big classes, 50 or 60 students in one room. And I was very sparsely equipped. We had some very dedicated teachers. That's what I remember most. Two of my teachers, one who taught us Marathi, our mother language, and another who taught English. They were very, very dedicated teachers that offered us a lot of things other than what we were learning in school.
I went to a Catholic school. It was very rigid, and the nuns came from Colombia. They were very friendly, but at the same time, they were very strict. It was based mainly on memorization, and we were punished. We didn't know, for instance, the tables. We got some whippings.
When I was going to elementary school, it was about 5 miles from home, and we had to walk 5 miles across a huge river. Sometimes it would flood. Sometimes we were crocodiles that we had to cross over. Sometimes we take our clothes off so they don't get wet when wading through the river. If it was flooded so much, then we just came back home. But if it was flooded reasonably, we would still go through the water. As a little boy, I helped my grandmother do the farming, helped my grandmother tend the goats, and so on.
I remember I was popular in the eyes of the teachers. Somehow I didn't get along with my fellow students. One day we had an election. Nobody, not even one, voted for me. I was really heartbroken. And then somehow the teacher came to at the end of the election, and she said to the entire student body, "Well, this girl has done the most for the school and for all of you, and let's redo it." So we redid the election, and the teacher basically moved me into this position. And ever since then, I felt really bad. It really shook me up. Nobody liked me. And I was able to be in this leadership position just because the teacher wanted me to be there. So there must be something I did wrong. And from then on, I was very careful. I learned a big lesson. I was very careful to be nice to everybody, my fellow students, to understand what they want, why I offended them, find out why, what a nasty person I was and why it is. And so from then on, I really started my management career, started paying attention to other people's feelings.
In a chemistry class one time, we took a rubber tube, clamped one end, and filled it with powdered carbon dioxide, and clamped the other end, and watched it grow and grow and grow and blow up, and frighten the teacher. We would make snowballs and go into the staff room and put them in the teacher's pockets.
I come from a Chinese background. I have some Chinese blood, Javanese, and Dutch. Yeah, but my features are Chinese, therefore I would be categorized as a Chinese. The good Lord blessed me with an opportunity to earn a scholarship. The top five students out of over 5,000 original applicants were selected. There are only five for the whole province at that time, and I was blessed to be one of the fives. Even then, the Indonesian officials at that time wanted to sabotage my going on the basis of my race as a Chinese, because he wanted his son to go in my place. As fate had it, at that time I happened to visit the office of the Ministry of Education, and his deputy was very kind. He is a very just man. He recognized that I won, and he also recognized that his boss, who had to go to Jakarta, the center of government, to deliver all of these applicants, left mine behind in his drawer, bottom drawer of his desk office. And so he alerted me. So, you know, I believe your document, your paperwork is still left behind in the drawer there. But I'm not supposed to know. But if you want to, if you still want to go, you better do something about it. So I took it upon myself to pull the drawer, and lo and behold, there it was. It's my paper. And there's another set of paperwork of another Chinese girl who also won. This man very kindly, he has a high sense of integrity. So he took it upon himself to help wrap it up in the official envelope, government envelope, so it would arrive safely to the center of Jakarta, to the Ministry of Education. So when this fellow came back, oh, he was furious, he was furious. And of course, his son got bumped in favor of the official winner.
For their own respective reasons, the immigrants found it necessary to move to America. For some, the journey here took several days. For others, it was a simple plane ride. However, for all the immigrants, the voyage to America had a long-lasting impact.
One of our friends had been in the United States for 7 years. Then he came home, and he persuaded his brother to come along to America because he said times were so much better here, you know. And then this his brother and he came over to our house and persuaded my dad that we should all go to America. And we all decided, Dad asked each one of us whether we were willing to go, and we were all excited to go. It was a large ship. The name was Berlin. But it was a large ship. It took 9 days to come across. It was really a real treat for us. And the conditions were real good there. Good food, everything was clean. The main thing I remember was the Statue of Liberty. That really hit home. I mean, I saw that and I would never forget that. The meaning that it had to it. At the time, I didn't really know why it was there, you know. But it means all the more now after I found out what it was for, you know.
Right at the time when we were ready to leave, we were stopped because at the very same time a martial law was imposed in Poland as the result of the strong democratic opposition movement that was just about to throw out the government. So for 2 years we were stopped for political reasons from leaving the country. All the passports were made invalid, so in order to leave we would have to get a new passport, and we were constantly denied the passports. The country was totally sealed, the borders were sealed. Nobody was allowed to leave the country for a certain period of time. After that, people could go, at least temporarily, for a certain time. It was very difficult to obtain the passport, so it was just constant reapplying and writing letters that we have to go, we have to go.
When I arrived at Kennedy, the plane was late and the connection to North Carolina had left. The airline put me up at a hotel in near the airport. The hotel told me that a meal was included. I remember having this meal, which was really quite large. I remember the salad. There was enough lettuce and tomatoes probably to feed my whole family in Ireland, and that was just a salad. And then along came the main meal, which was half a chicken, and I had never eaten more than a chicken leg in my life, and here was a half a chicken. What was I going to do with it all? So there was. I was really impressed by the amount of food that Americans ate, because it wasn't really necessary.
All my friends that were here would send pictures of them having parties, laughing, having good time. They never talk and write letters. They never talk about the problems of this country. So I thought, gee, this is an opportunity to come. Oh, my parents was devastated when I told them I was coming. They thought that what would you do in that terrible place where everybody divorced in a Protestant land? What are you going to do there? I came here, I was 22. I was already a nurse. I came to my first place was Jersey City, New Jersey. I came alone, but there were 16 other women or other nurses in the plane that I've met. We were all going to the same destination in New Jersey. The 16 people I still have contact with, and they're my best friends.
I went to Beijing Language Institute. That's where my dad was the vice president, and I studied English there. And then after I finished school over there, I learned how to speak English. I thought, wow, now I can go to America. I could understand everybody.
When each of the immigrants arrived in the United States, they were confronted by many new customs, as well as the prospect of a whole new life ahead of them. Some adapted to the new ways of doing things more easily than others, finding ways to fit in. Others had a harder time getting to know the culture of America.
When I arrived in Durham, I remember one of the first things I noticed was the toilet system. It had just been changed from segregated. Up to then, there were segregated toilets in the United States. And I found the men's toilet rather strange because there were two doors into it and the wall had been knocked down. And I remember asking why this was. And they said, well, this was because these other toilets were for black men at one stage. You carry a lot of your own prejudices when you come to a country because you need that to bolster your self-esteem. Because you've arrived in a new country, it's different, and when things are different, you tend to fight those things. So I would tend to think that things in Ireland were better. Simple things like the food was better in Ireland. When I, deep down, I knew that it wasn't. The weather was better in Ireland because I wasn't used to the intense heat in North Carolina or the humidity. So there's a tendency to say, well, you know, it's fine here, but I know something better. So in that way, you puff out your chest, you make yourself feel more important than what you really are.
When we got to New Jersey, the first time I saw in the helicopter was the Statue of Liberty. And of course you have read all about it. It was really an awesome sight and experience. It was very clean compared to Manila. The cities were really clean. And it was really impressive, this big building in New York City.
At Berlin Airport, they had huge doors that were like 20 feet, 30 feet tall glass doors. I came with two bags in my hand and wanted to keep a bag down to open the door. When I came closer to the door, it went open. And I wasn't sure why it was opening. I thought somebody was opening it from behind. So I went back to pick up my bag and the door closed. I came back closer to the door and opened again. I didn't realize that there was a photo cell that was automatically opening the door. I went back and forth two or three times until I realized that there was an automatic door opener. So it was my first encounter with high tech, I guess.
The two things that surprised me first was the signs all over the place for food. And I said, what is this? What are they selling? It was Kentucky Fried Chicken, pizza, selling. And I said, why do they need to advertise? You know, why is the need to do that? And I still don't understand. Because you eat when you have a need. I mean, there is some infatuation in food. And so, and another thing was, the houses. The houses, of course, were different. They all had a kind of a pitch, a roof. And also, they didn't have fences. And I felt like, naked. I said, why? They don't have protection, you know, no? And I thought anybody could come and look through the window. And, of course, now I know that people here value privacy. And they don't do that.
I feel very familiar when I look at this, we call this flat place, a cornfield, because Beijing is a basin, my hometown, and there are a lot of farmlands. And so at the bottom of all the hills, it's kind of flat. And it reminds me of home a lot. We have a lot of corn, not very much soybean, a lot of wheat. So I said, I feel comfortable here. I like the flatness.
Once in America, the immigrants had to find a way to stay legally. However, getting citizenship was not as easy as a trip to the courthouse, and some resisted citizenship because they felt that it took their traditional culture and beliefs away from them.
I did not become a citizen for many years because I felt where I had come from, the political system and the social systems I felt were superior to what they were in the United States. And I felt becoming an American would give up what I had felt were important things. There's a great deal of money in the United States. There are a lot of wealthy individuals, but there are also a lot of there's a lot of poverty. So I've tended to, for a long time, felt that I, by becoming a U.S. citizen, I would become part of that. But then after a while, I realized that the only way you can change things is to be a citizen, because I couldn't vote. So I became a citizen, and then that allows me to vote on issues. I'm an Irish person living in the United States. I have a piece of paper that says I'm an American, but as I said before, it's very... I didn't grow up in the United States. I'm an Irish man clothed with American plastic.
It was always a one-year visa, so every year we had to take care of having that extended. And after a certain number of years, we had to change it completely, because that was the kind of visa that required at the maximum of 5 years going back to original country for 2 years. So we had to change the visa. We have become citizens several years ago.
After we got married, I came to this country, I got a green card. And I had that until 5 years ago, when I decided to get the U.S. citizenship. The reason why I waited so long to get the U.S. citizenship was because with the permanent visa, I could do anything I wanted except vote. And I had a son. My first child was a son. And with me, there were fresh memories of the Vietnam War. And I was conscious that this country is involved in international issues. And I didn't want my son, because of the Vietnam War, be fighting in another country. And so that's why I kept my resident visa, because having the Ecuadorian citizenship, I could go back if they ask my son to go and fight for another country. I would take my son back and it would be no problem. So I kept the U.S. citizenship, the Ecuadorian citizenship until he was 22. And after that, I changed to U.S. citizenship, because I realized that this is my country, this was home for my children, and I wanted to be part of it. And also, I wanted to make a difference in the election process. And so I immediately after I got that, I went and vote, and and I feel very good about that, yes.
As much as I thought about it, I didn't see a very big difference between being a citizen and not being a citizen. In terms of my personal benefit, it's not going to be affected if I become or not become a U.S. citizen. So at this point, I'm not thinking about doing it. My children here, because they were born here, in the future, and they will be citizens, and I will raise them as a U.S. citizen. They do pledge their legion to Star and Stripe. Whereas in my case, because I was raised in China, and you always put your loyalty where your heart is, and I want my children to put loyalty where their heart is, which is the United States, but me, I'm too old.
Although some of the immigrants chose to apply for U.S. citizenship, their decision did not prevent them from celebrating many of their ethnic or religious holidays. However, the manner in which they celebrate these holidays, like Christmas and Easter, are different from what has become the standard practice here.
The main difference between dinner at Christmas here and in Poland is that it's strictly no meat kind of dinner. There is supposed to be at least 12 different dishes served during the dinner. Totally new concept that we were introduced to here is Easter bunny. That's something totally unheard of. It's small chickens is the symbol of Easter, but definitely not bunny.
Well, the biggest tradition was Christmas, because at that time of the year we had a chicken. When I was growing up, we had chicken twice a year at Christmas and Easter. It lasted a week, but it was a big chicken, and we didn't eat very much. On St. Patrick's Day, which usually occurred, as it does now, during Lent, that was another day when there was a fair amount of festivities. We would eat a rather larger meal, because since it was in the middle of Lent, we were supposed to fast and abstain, and we looked forward to St. Patrick's Day because we would eat eat candy then. Because when I was growing up, children never had any candy during Lent.
Well, Easter they would have what they called a panettone. That's the bread with the raisins and the candied fruit. Of course, now you can get it all over. And they would have breads made like into a dove, and lamb. A lot of people would have lamb for Easter, and more or less the same, you know. Families would get together. They'd have Holy Saturday. We would fast, though, on Good Friday, all day Saturday, until 12 o'clock Saturday. We wouldn't have any dairy products. No meat, no butter, no milk, no cream. And my mother would always cook spaghetti with anchovy sauce, with oil, no cheese. And we'd go to work, we'd have jelly sandwiches because you couldn't have any dairy products until Saturday at noon. Then they'd have the blessing of the holy water, and then Easter would start.
Mealtime is something that is a time to get together with the family, and is a precious time that, like for instance, when I was growing up, we stay most of the time outside the house. But breakfast, lunch, and dinner, wherever we were, we knew that my father wanted us at the table, clean, and, you know, ready. So I don't know how we managed to do that, because, you know, we knew the consequences of not being on time for the meals. And so that stays with me even until now. Mealtime is something that I stress with my children, that we all have to get together and that's the priority. And now with everybody being busy, that's still something important that we have kept in the family. We sometimes take 2 hours for dinner. And of course, I make a big effort to prepare things that I know they like. And so it's kind of, I do it conscious and unconscious. And so they enjoy that, and I do too. And so it's something that I want to preserve for the future generation.
Each immigrant, even after living many years in this country, has their own impressions about the United States and Champaign-Urbana. Some feel that coming here was an excellent decision, while others would not have made the same choice if given a second chance. Many continue to assess American society and are still evaluating the choice they made when they immigrated to this country. Some are still adjusting to the place they now call home.
I think Germany is or was not well known for its order. And here, everything functions very well too, but I think it is more loosely. You don't notice the organization behind so well.
There is no family life here. I mean, in Poland is, again, it's changing too. But when we were growing up, multi-generation family was normal. I lived together with my grandparents, with parents. I didn't have any siblings, but probably I would live with them too. So in Poland it was quite natural that grandparents would take care of children, of grandchildren. I think that's what's the most valuable is that you have a lot of choices in life. You can become anything that you want. Even so simple thing as college education. In Poland, you wouldn't see a person above 30 in college. Here, I see a lot of retired people taking classes and so on, just to grow some of their interests and so on. And that for me is really important.
What I found is that what is good about this place is the people, the university. And there are a lot of things that, especially now, that I become to appreciate. All this university environment, this intellectual stimulation that is going on continuously in different fields, the arts, awareness about international issues, about the environment, you name it, is here. It's all a question of taking advantage of what is going on. So after all these years, if somebody asked me if I want to move, I don't know. I would have to think about it because, we are animals of adaptation. I guess that is one of our good quality we humans have. And so I got used to. I have a beautiful garden that, I look forward every spring to. What has survived in my garden every year. And I look forward to the summers. I love autumn. I kind of like some cold weather and snow. And I can't believe that.
There's no place like the United States. It's fun to go back and to visit, but it's good to be here. I wouldn't want to trade it for any other country.
We'd like to thank the following people from the community who have shared their stories of coming to America with us. Mr. Subhash Bhagwat, Ms. Yin Liu, Dr. Walter McGuire, Ms. Lila Peters, Ms. Elizabeth Scarupa, Ms. Lopez Smith, Dr. Ezekiel Calapini, Dr. Ruth Lorby, Ms. Teresa Osterber, Ms. Zoila Rosati, Mr. Peter Scarupa, and Mr. Peter Tan. We'd also like to thank the staff at WILL who provided technical assistance. Dan Simeone, Dave Dickey, Brian Wagner, Craig Cohen, and Denise Perry. Journey to a New World was produced by the sub-freshman class of University Laboratory High School in Urbana. The executive producer was Jeremy Hobson, class of 1999.